questions? And what I consider the main questions, perhaps what you consider the main question. Okay. So we're in Perek Chavalos, Pasuk Dalet. This is towards the end of the period of wandering in the wilderness. That's important to know, the context in which the story occurs. And they're beginning to make to move towards the point where they're going to enter the land. So it says that they traveled from Hor HaHor, from that mountain, Hor, Derech Yamsuf, via the Yamsuf, which means they were going backwards, as Rashi points out. We spoke with Eretz Edom to go around the land of Edom, but they weren't permitted to go through the land of Edom. So they had to take a circuitous path to go around, which contributed to the weariness that they felt. It sort of wore them down. Like Sikhtar, Nefesh Ha'am HaDerech. That's a key phrase. What does it mean? How do you translate it? The soul of the people became weary. Tikta doesn't mean actually weary. Sort of kotar means short, restricted. Right? They became like restricted. What does that mean? Rashi explains. There's a lot of Rashi in this. But just briefly, he says an interesting thing. I'm sure we can all relate to this. But tikta, it's in the middle of the Rashi there. But tikta nafsho, he quotes. For Amel, Rashi learns it's by Derech, because the Pasuk doesn't point out exactly what caused them to get so weary, what wore them out. So the answer is, it's the general travail of being on the situation that they were in, being on the road, in a state, in that state that they were traveling for 40 years. And now they have to go, Rashi says, now they have to go back. To them, it became a greater burden, the burden of the road. So Rashi says, V'chol dom ha'kasha al adam, anything which a person finds difficult, no bo loshon kitzur nefesh. The terminology of restriction of the soul applies, is applicable. Adam shatorech bo'olav, like someone who's just been handed a burden, and you just say, I don't have any room to carry it. I just don't have any room for this. It's interesting, because we think along these lines, like the person is, things are going well, and you're having a fairly good day and something comes up, you can tolerate it, you can absorb it, you've got room to deal with it. But when you've had a bad day, one thing after another, then you have that last thing, the straw that breaks the camel's back, I just can't deal with it, I just don't have any room, I can't absorb it. That's basically what Rashi's saying over here. The Ein Daito Rechava, and his mind is not broad enough. He can't lekabel al tzadavar, he can't absorb it. The Ein Lo Mokom b'sof libo, he has no place in his heart. Lugger sham also atar, for that taint to dwell in it. And so it's a very apt psychological description. Sometimes you just don't have any room to carry it. And you can all, I'm sure, relate to this, to these various states when, I guess when you're feeling good and content with your situation, so you can tolerate. So then something comes up which is a burden. But you can tolerate it, you have room for it, you can deal with it, you can assimilate it. But when you're in a fragile kind of a state, and you're just barely getting by, as things are, and then a new burden comes upon you, you just can't, you feel like, I just don't have any room for this, I can't handle it. That's basically the state they were in, descriptively. And that's the term that ticks out nefesh ha'am. They became constricted, they became very weary. It's interesting also, not to compare, when you just to enable you to understand it a little bit better, when you're traveling, that does happen, you get worn down. Traveling is a wearying kind of experience, interestingly enough. Even today, when the situation is so radically different, they had none of the comfort. There's no way to compare when we're going, when we travel, because we have every possible luxury, you'd hardly even call it travel, yet there is a phenomenon, right? It's weary, like a person is weary from traveling. What do you mean you're weary? Just traveled, traveled to cross country, 6 hours to California, 6-7 hours flight. So, what were you doing? You got a plane. You got a plane, is that now? It's a big, tremendous thing in what I went through. Can you imagine from New York to California? And 6 hours, this is something. So, I analyzed, at least in your scene. yeah, getting fed and giving drinks or being brought to you, etc., people would laugh. But nevertheless, there is a reality that you come home exhausted and you don't expect to be bothered. When you come home, you know, you see your parents and everything, and you don't expect your mother to, you know, to ask you to please vacuum the floor at that point. You know, you get a little excited. I just got back from a long journey. And what were you doing? I was sitting on the plane. I was working very hard. I've been traveling all day. So, but nevertheless, there is a truth. The point, the reason for it is, what's the reason for it? Anybody? Anybody? Why? You should at least be cognizant of the reasons for your emotional states. The question with this, I was just thinking of a shot I gave. If you remember, I said this over when I went out to Tiff. I gave a shirt in one of my shirts out there. It said when Avram was going down to Mitzrayim, and he was afraid that they would take Sarah, but they found a very beautiful. Because the person said, he didn't know Yadati, behold, now I know that you're Ishi, an exceedingly beautiful woman. So it was an exceedingly beautiful woman. So the way it's stated is like he suddenly recognized. Like he didn't know this before. So there's different Rashi to the few different Shatim. The Rashi says because of the tzina, the modesty that existed between them, he never really took cognizance of her beauty, or kamshat, or which is difficult. But that's not the plain shot. In fact, it was kind of Rashi said the plain shot is, the plain shot is that until now I didn't have to worry about the fact. I knew all along that you're beautiful. Until now there was no problem. Now it's a problem because we're coming into a land of people that are steeped in immorality. Another shot is that this showed her true beauty, because most people lose their beauty when they have to travel. That was the another shot. But she was so beautiful that even when she was on the road and traveling, in that state, she still had her beauty. So the question I analyzed all of them, but the question on that one was, what's the point of the medrash? Why is it important for us to know how beautiful she was? Well, she was beautiful, okay, but now to go, what are we learning from this? That she was so beautiful that even when she didn't have her, you know, her makeup and everything that she needed, she was still beautiful. I mean, so what's the point? So I wanted to say that there's a psychological factor. The reason why, see, the Torah is not talking beauty. Beauty is not just, as you all know, just purely physical. It's a certain attitude that a person conveys, a certain inner, religious thing, like an inner a glow, so to speak. In other words, a person is happy with their lot and they're content. It shines in their whole appearance. Certain appearance is more than just a physical thing. So Sarah partook of that inner beauty as well. And the reason why on a journey why people lose it is because it's psychological things, because they can't tolerate that they're being separated from their little conveniences. It shows the extent to which we're pampered. To think about it, it's an interesting point. A person goes away, so it's like a tension. Why is it a tension? Because they're separated. They are worried, how much can I bring along? It's like an anxiety. So therefore, when people are deprived of their petty conveniences that, you know, they pamper themselves with, the luxuries, we're always in a state of excessive luxury. We don't realize actually how good we've got it. Because you see people complain. If a person gets treatment, the second class treatment, I mean, relatively speaking, it's being treated like a king. But we're so pampered that we complain about every little thing, every little detail has to be put in. So that shows, the reason why the Torah was pointing it out was to show her perfection. That the fact is that she was totally, she accepted reality. She was totally content with her situation. So these differences, the fact that she was traveling and she had to make adjustments, did not in any way detract from her underlying happiness. So that's the reason why it is such a burden. Even if you're traveling first class, you're still going to have that sense of you've been through a tough experience. Because it's a psychological phenomenon. You gear up. It's a state of anxiety. And when a person's in a state of anxiety, then that wears them down much more than the physical. If a person has a different attitude, so really we sit back and relax. What's the big deal? But there's so much anxiety attendant upon it before you get there and this and that, so that's why you feel like you've been through an ordeal. Alright, now of course in this situation it was much more aligned with the reality. The reality of being in the wilderness was a burdensome thing. And nevertheless, it reflected their moral state. They should not have allowed themselves to get into this situation, to a state where they were rebelling. They were about to rebel against against God and against Moshe. But this was something which triggered it off. The fact that it appeared to them that they would have to do even more travel. Okay? Now what happened? By Davar on Bill came over Moshe. And the people spoke about God and about Moshe. So Pasuk Hay, see the Pasuk Dalet described the cause, the immediate cause. Pasuk Hay basically is describing the Chet. And the essence of the Chet is in which word? Anybody? Tayyidaber. Speech. So everyone should learn something just from that, that according to the Torah, speech is one of the most serious areas in terms of Chet. See, they didn't do anything over here. In the whole story, they didn't do anything. The whole essence of their Chet consisted in speech. Lama held Yisunim in Israel. Why did he take us out of Egypt? Lamos Bamidbar, to die in the wilderness. Kiyin Lechem V'yin Mayim, for there is no bread and there is no water. So, really, the cause was the fact that they were weary. They had no tolerance level, is what Rashi is saying. They'd lost their tolerance level for the travails of the wilderness. But, of course, that's not what they said. Because as soon as a person, once a person is overcome by a certain emotion, and he's discontent with the situation, he's got to find something to justify it. He's got to find something to justify it. In most cases, the justification, the rationalization is not the real cause. It's just something that they're seeing. The emotions have to seize upon something. They have to present something which makes sense. So there's no bread and there's no water. That was the problem. The problem is we're starving here. But one second. But the truth of the matter is that God has provided for them very well in the wilderness. God has set a table for them in the wilderness with the most perfect food you can have, the man. So one said, V'nafshenu katza, b'lechem ha'chol keel. And our souls despise. We're fed up with that lechem ha'chol keel, with that light bread. So Rashi says that the word kata is the same thing, the same word as kisar. The word before, it means the same thing. Abzer, Rashi says, Russian kisar nefesh, umiyos. It's an expression that I can't take it anymore. Like, they despise. They despise the mud. Of course, bear in mind that there's a medrash over here. There's an implication in the term colloquial. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi quotes the Gemara. Rasha Rafisha Man Nivla Bevaram, because the man was absorbed in their organs, in their body. Karu colloquial. That's why they called it colloquial. Amru Hasid Haman Hazeh Sheyitbach the Me'enu. Well, this mud is going to explode in our intestines. In other words, this is dangerous stuff. Cloquial, kilkel, it's destructive. That's not that they said, you know, that's an implication. The implication is that, they didn't say this openly, but the implication is that this is like poison. It's going to kill us. It's going to explode. Klum yesh lud isha shamat nasin amosu. Is there a person born to a woman? In other words, is there a human being that ingests and doesn't excrete? So now they were saying something else. That apparently the mun was food which was designed by God. So it wasn't a natural food, it was provided, and it was the most perfect food. So that it was really to their benefit that everything was utilized completely by the body, so that there was no excretion, which was really a good. But they took this fact and they turned it into a bed. So of course we have to understand how this fits in. So why do we have to know this? Obviously this is telling us something about the nature of the chet. Okay? Now let's proceed. I want to go through the story. My method is to go through the story, then make some of these points, and then set up the issues. So what happened? So Dalet is the cause, He is the Chay, and Vav is the punishment. Alright? Vayashachar Hashem Ba'am, and God sent against the people, Eitz HaNechashim HaSrachim, the fiery serpent. Now what is fiery serpent as opposed to, what does it mean by fiery serpent according to Rashi? What's the fiery? Poisonous. Poisonous. Rashi says, Sarfim Eitz Adam Ba'aretz Shineim. They burn you, so to speak. Doesn't mean literally burn. It means poison with their venom. Vayanashu es ha'am, and they bit the people. Vayamas amrav Yisrael. And a large contingent of people were killed. Okay. Now, let's ask the question as we go along. What question should we raise at this point? The secondary purpose, aside from studying Chumash, is studying the methodology. And I'd like, you know, it's very important. Whenever I teach something, I try not just to give over the information, but to show you how we arrive at it, to enable you to do the same thing. Also, in this situation that we're in this summer, learning Gemara, I want to show you the significance of Gemara, how one flows to the other, that we're using the same methodology, the same method of approach that we're trying to perfect when we study Gemara. Using that method to apply to Chumash will open up the Chumash to you. And that, without knowledge of that type of methodology, the Chumash will more or less be closed, superficial kind of. You won't really get at the bottom what's going on here. In other words, that's one of the reasons why it's so vital to know how to study Gemara. Because it's not, I mean, Gemara itself is important in and of itself. I'm not saying it's the only, there's many, many benefits of Gemara. But one of them is that the entire knowledge that's contained in Torah is structured in the same way. And one method must be utilized to unlock the secrets of the Gemara and the secrets of Chumash. You're not going to really be able to get too far in Chumash or philosophy of Torah if you don't know the methodology of studying Torah, which you will only get through the study of Gemara. So that's a very good question. How we have a principle that the punishment of God, what does it mean? First of all, what does it mean that God punishes? That itself is something you should ask. Why does God punish when we disobey? It's not what most people would think. There is a certain emotional idea that most people have, which you have to undo, because you grow up with certain unconscious ideas that you carry with you, baggage, so to speak, which you have to analyze. It's part of it's just part of reality. I mean, as a child, when you learn it, it makes a certain impression on you. And perhaps certain things your teachers told you reinforce it, perhaps not, but you carry with you certain ideas. Now, everybody as a child will learn this and will imagine, well, of course, God is angry with us. We disobeyed God. We better be careful. Because if we get God angry, God's going to punish them. It's just like your mommy and daddy. If you disobey them, they get upset, and then they're going to punish you. Of course, we know that idea is totally false. As an adult, and it may sound very simple, but it's not so simple. When you have to analyze it in yourself how deeply embedded this idea is. It forms, by and large, the overwhelming majority of adults have this notion. Either if they don't openly acknowledge it, but psychologically I'm sure they have this idea that we displease God, He's going to punish us, that's the way it should be. But of course this doesn't make any sense. Why doesn't it make any sense? Because the thing we said in the first day, there's absolutely no way that our service of God could do anything for God. We don't make God happy. We don't contribute anything. We don't make God happy. We can't do anything for God. There's nothing that we could do for God. That's something the Rambam makes clear in the Mora, that's the Yesod of Yesodos. We can't do anything for God. And conversely, we cannot do anything against God. We can't harm God in any way. So therefore, God gave us, whatever God gave us in terms of the commandments, is purely for our benefit. And our failure to keep the commandments is purely to our detriment. We're hurting ourselves. If that's the case, so why should there be punishment? Why should there be punishment? It doesn't make sense. In other words, in a human context, there's got to be punishment, right? Because I can't let you get away with it. Either you rebelled against me, and I want to maintain my authority, or whatever the case may be. You're destroying society. Society has to punish you because you're harming society. Whatever the case may be. But this doesn't apply over here. So therefore, how do we understand the concept of punishment then? Anybody? Yeah, that's again part of the chesed, so to speak, of God. Every term we use is so to speak. That's again for our benefit, that not only does God give us a system which enables us, if we're intelligent and we abide by it, to perfect ourselves, it is purely for our benefit, and that would have been diagonal. That would have been enough. The fact that we have such a thing. And no one else has it. We have it. The whole world is in darkness, basically, as you know. And we have the light. We have the true ideas. We should have that would be sufficient. But that even when we stray, which is due to our own stupidity and obstinacy, God punishes us. God does not let us without, as we see in our other situations, by the generation of the flood, the sun, and so forth, if people reach a certain point, they dehumanize, they're no longer worthy of existence, they lose their existence. So, if we deviate from the Torah, we're not worthy of existence. And that's it, we had the greatest opportunity. But still, no, there's a system of punishment. That God does not let us go too far, and God brings punishment against us. We call it punishment because of terminology. Because it appears to us, it's painful. It's painful, and therefore we experience it as though it were a punishment. But in reality, it is for our benefit. Because without it, we would be destroyed. It's like an operation that a doctor operates. It's very painful and all of that. But it's really a cure. It's a cure. And the same thing over here. It's a cure. So if that's the case, then the principle is it has to be mida keneged mida. Since the entire purpose of the onesh is for the benefit of the tzibur to improve us, then it has to relate back to the chait and operate in such a way that it leads to our improvement. So therefore the question is, what is the purpose of this punishment of the snakes? Okay, now in order to answer that, we're going to have to define what the underlying chait was, right? And then we're going to explain how the punishment relates to that. Now the punishment is snakes. So we'd like to understand why snakes. In other words, the general idea of the punishment was that they should be smitten. They should be attacked and smitten by animals. But there must be a reason why God chose snakes. So what is the reason for the particular choice of snakes? And even more to the point, or more precise, more specific, is Nechashim HaSaf. In other words, it's not by accident that it was poisonous snakes. We should be able to account for that fact as well. Right? That's not just arbitrary. The person makes a point of it. If it just said snakes, then that's it. I wouldn't have gone into the issue. What kind of snakes? It wouldn't have been important. But the person does say Sraphim, and Rashi points out that that means poison, venom. So that too must have something to do with it. Let's continue now. So what happened? Was it effective or not? Was the punishment effective or not? That's the next question. Zion, what happened? Vayavar Amel Moshe, the people came to Moshe, Vayomru Chatanu, and they said, we have sinned. Kidibarnu Baroshem Vavach, because we spoke against God and against you. And against you. Ispale Olar Hashem, pray to God, the Yasser may alenu at Hanachash, that he may remove from us the snake. Okay? So what Pasuk Zion, what does it seem to indicate? Tshuva. Tshuva, because the essence of Tshuva is Chatanu. Chatanu. And they even said what their chait was, Ki dibanu var Hashem vavach. And then they appealed to Moshe to pray to God. Pray to God. V'yasa me'alenu at ha'nachash. And Moshe, v'yisbal Moshe v'yaram, because Moshe acted properly, because when people, they sinned against Moshe too. But the halacha is when somebody sins against you, so you're supposed to rebuke and not allowed to hate him. You're not allowed to hate your brother in your life. If he comes and he apologizes, so then you're mechuyev to forgive him. You're mechuyev to forgive him. You're not allowed to
refuse that that's an after, a person that refuses to forgive. So of course Moshe Rabbeinu forgave them, and he did what they asked. He certainly prayed for them. Now the next pasuk is very difficult, because you would have expected that the story more or less should have come to a conclusion at this point, right? Either they were worthy of being saved, either they should have been saved, or they should have been just not saved or destroyed, whatever. That I couldn't predict, only because now they're appealing to God. So God either accepts the tshuva, and the tshuva God doesn't. That's where it should have ended on either one of those cases. Either, okay, you know, God forgave, God said, like Dr. Cheda Eagle, God accepted the tshuva and forgave them. Or no. But what happens is some strange kind of a situation over here. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, God said to Moshe, Atzel Chatzara, make a serpent. Make for you a serpent. Vesimoso al Neis, and place it on a pole. Vahoya kol anashuch, and it'll be whoever is bitten, v'ra'a oso v'chad, and he will see it and live. Vayas Moshe nechash nechoshes, and Moshe made a snake out of copper, Rashi learns, nechoshes. Vayasimei wal anes, and he placed it on a pole. V'hoyam nashach hanachash et ish, and it was when a snake bit a man, v'hibit al nechash hanachoshes, and he gazed at the copper snake, v'choy, and he lived. So, of course, this is the most problematic part of the entire thing. What's the problem over here? What thing is this? How does this work? How does a snake save? I mean, it seems when a person that doesn't know anything gets a false idea that there's some kind of voodoo, some kind of magic. It's not like a funny thing, like a voodoo kind of thing, like a magic kind of thing. Looking, where does we find such a thing that that looking at an image of something can kill you, and the whole idea, and why would God, actually of course you're going to say that God is the one that cured them, the miracle, but what's the point of it? What's the reason for this whole thing? Okay, and you could ask the question, why this particular, the snake itself is the thing which, the snake itself is the thing which attacks them, so why the image of the snake is going to save them? And looking at the snake, what kind of thing is that? So you look at the snake. The whole thing is fraught with difficulty. Those are the basics. If you have more specific questions, sure, go ahead. And the Gemara asked the question with regards to the hands of Moshe. So let's take a look at the Rashi. Rashi says a number of interesting things. We'll do the Rashi Ches, because the pasuk seems to make a distinction. If you study it very carefully, the pasuk makes a distinction between anyone who is bitten and those who are bitten by the snake, and it uses two different words in pasuk Ches. When God tells Moshe to make the serpent and place it on a pole, then it mentions whoever was bitten. It doesn't mention snakes. And there it says, Vara Oso. He'll see it. In Pasuk Tes, it refers to those who are bitten by a snake. And there it says, Vehibit. And Hebit means to gaze intently. So Chazal, pick up on that. Take a look at Rashi. Kol HaNoshuch. Afilu Kelev HaChamor Nosho. Even if a dog or a donkey bit him, Haya Nazuk Umas Nuna Baoleh. So he'd be damaged, he'd be wounded, and would get weaker. Elish and Ashika Panachash the Maharas Muhammad. But the bite of the snake he'd have less time. The poison would kill him more quickly. But Kachnamakan Vara Oso. Therefore it says here, Vara Oso. And he would see it. Re'iyabalma, just looking at it was enough.
by the bite of the snake, it says, and he would gaze. Voya amnashach hanachash azish vihibit, etc. Shlohayim amayar noshech hanachash lesrapos. For the one who was bitten by a snake would not get healed very quickly. Elam came mabitbo the kavana, unless he would gaze at it with kavana. Now, this is really strange, right? Because now we have a whole new situation over here. Now it turns out, in fact, that it wasn't just snakes. The Torah has only been pointing snakes, but that was the most serious case. But they were bitten by other animals as well. And the ones who were bitten by other animals as well, that wasn't so terrible. They didn't die so quickly, they had more time. And their cure wasn't as severe, all they had to do was look. And now, there were those who were bitten by the snake. And those who were bitten by the snake were in greater danger. You didn't have too much time, you would die much more quickly. You didn't die instantaneously, because otherwise there's nothing, you know, there's no way to help you. But you were in a more emergency situation, right? Emergency. And therefore, and they, but, it's all, but not only that, but they had to do something different. Their activity was a bit different as well. It was one general activity of this copper snake, which somehow the thing that saved you, which we don't understand. But even with regard to that, there were two groups. One group had to just look at it, and that was enough. The other group had to gaze intently. So that requires explanation of what's going on. You know, what's behind that? How do we understand that type of phenomenon? Okay? Let me just conclude. The Rashi, the Amar Rabbeinu, and our rabbis have said, the Nachash Meimis Omachaya, does a snake kill or live? In other words, they ask that question. How does this work? What kind of thing is this? That was his mind, shall you show him the Stockman Klape Mala? But rather, when the Jews gazed towards heaven, when we're shopping in Slibam Lavim Shabashamayim, and they subordinated their hearts to their Father in heaven, Ayim Israel, they became healed. The Yamro Ayim Ukim, but if not, they were wiped out. Ah, so Rashi, basing himself on Hazal, tells us what's going on over here. He eliminates that terrible notion that there's something inherent in the snake itself. There's some kind of magical thing going on. Doesn't matter at all. It's rather something different. And Chazal said the same thing with regard to the hands of Moshe by the case of when they fought against Amalek, you know, when the hands of Moshe were raised and the Jews were victorious. What does it mean? How can the hands of Moshe conduct war? Same thing. Rather, when they gazed towards heaven and subordinated their hearts to their Father in heaven, then they were victorious. The problem with that is what? What's the difficulty with this answer? I mean, it is remove the problem and then create another problem. They already went to God, true. And they already went to God. Or if that wasn't enough, so then what? It doesn't explain anything about the snake. So what's the thing with the snake? Well, how does the snake fit into that picture? So now you're telling me that it really is something else. So you're getting out of the problem, but you're getting out of it so much that you're creating a whole new problem for me. So then I don't need the snake anymore. Or you're not explaining how the snake fits into the picture. Rather it's something with regard to a change of heart. It's a change of heart with regard to God. That's very nice, that makes sense, but it doesn't explain the issue of the snake. So these are all the problems now, right? Now we've got a whole bunch of problems. Of course, you see another thing from this is that it's absurd to even attempt to study the Torah without the Chazal, without the Chazal. I mean, it's a total absurdity. The Jewish groups and certainly Christian or whatever, to study the so-called Bible, just with the text, and they think that it's somehow more pure because it's just written. No, just show me where it's written, just what's written, is absurd. I mean, it's written in such a way, it was designed in such a way that it's not to be understood without the underlying explanations that were transmitted, to the Masorah.
Very good point.
That they thought they did Shuvah, or whatever it was, they regretted, and they said, pray. What did they pray for? Get the problem out of here. Get these snakes out of here. That's what they wanted. And what was God's answer? No. I'm not going to do that. I will write. The snakes will remain, but I'll give you a cure. That's the way, in other words, that's what happened. They wanted out. They said, okay, enough. The point, you made the point. We got the message. And so now that we got the message, they just pray to remove the snakes, the other. Right? The Yasameh was a Nakash. In other words, they recognize that this is a punishment from God. They were honest about that. And it seems like a good tshuva. So now take away the disease. God said no. Apparently, God says no. The snake will still be there, but I'm going to give you a cure. I'm going to give you the punishment with a cure. So if you want, you're a little bit better off now because you can utilize the cure. But that's it. Why? We'll have to see. But that's the answer to your question. The first thing I'd like to take up is the idea of the snake. It's not the snake, but obviously, is a major theme in this whole story. The whole idea of snakes. Okay? What is the idea of the snake? So let's take a look at Rashi. And Rashi, again, quoting Chazal, explains to us why the snake was the proper instrument for the punishment. So take a look at Rashi. And they bit the people. So Rashi gives two reasons. Yavo nachash shaloka alotot diba. Let the nachash come, which was smitten for its speech. For it seduced the woman, Chava. Vipara, and take revenge, mimotzie diba, from those who brought forth evil speech. Because we said that was their sin, that they spoke evilly. So, basically, Rashi makes it clear that the essential chesed that being spitten for is the chesed of Lashon Hara. So, clearly, central to understanding this whole parasha is a deeper understanding of what's going on with Lashon Hara. That's one reason. Yavo Nachash, let the Nachash come, Shekol Haminin Nitzamin Lo Tam Echad. That all different things have one taste. It can't distinguish among tastes. Everything tastes the same to the Nachash. Tastes like that. The Pura make Fuye Tova. And let it take revenge from those who will cup with toe. Shedavar Echad Mishtanalahem Lakama Matama. That is to say, they were cup with toe. Two things over here. First of all, it was Lashon Hara. And also, let's not forget that they sinned in terms of cup with toe. And how is that? Because they degraded the man. The man was a wonderful thing. As we know, because I'll say that it had the capacity to taste like many different things. It was a wonderful food, and it could be prepared in different ways. And it tasted like almost like anything you wanted. So it was a wonderful kind of thing. And they came and they took something which was really good, and they negated it. They were cuffing toe. They said it's terrible. And somehow the snake is a fitting type of a instrument of making that point. And the question, what does this actually mean? It's like it doesn't seem to flow. I mean, superficially, because the snake spoke. Because the snake spoke, sinned with speech. So you sinned with speech. So therefore, it has to be a snake. I mean, what really has to do with the other? Or because the snake, the second one is ruled even harder, because the snake is in that situation that everything tastes the same to it. So therefore, because you distorted something which has many tastes, and you say, you deny that, you negated it, so therefore, let's get trying to understand this on a deeper level. It just seems like very superficial. It doesn't really go to the heart of the matter. I'd like to try and understand the idea on a deeper level, what Rashi's really getting at. You get it. The purpose of the punishment is to help them. How does it work? Now, it wasn't an arbitrary thing. God chose the nachash. God chose poisonous snakes. So it's got to be something very significant. It has to relate back to the character of the sin. And the sin wasn't a simple thing. The sin was very complicated. It was very complex because even after they did tshuva, it wasn't enough. You needed some harsh measure over here. This whole measure of the copper snake. So we have to understand the idea of the snake. That's what I'm getting at. I'd like to bear with me for a while. Let me try and elucidate a little bit, and then we can ask all the questions we want. See, I think that the Torah over here is operated. There's a level of symbolism over here. That the snake over here is symbolic.
It's symbolic. Now, where, and it's intended, see, it's intended to convey. The Torah is using something which is concrete, to take a concrete object, in order to bring home a point to them, because that's how people function. That it's not enough sometimes to just tell a person a lesson, to just tell a person an idea. Like we've discussed the philosophy of mezuzah, say. Philosophy of mezuzah, tefillin, tzitzis bevigdo. That the tzitzis is it's a concept, it's an idea, that a person should be cognizant of the fact that his clothing. He's involved in clothing. Clothing is the protection of the body. That a person should be involved in taking care of the body. When he's involved in taking care of the body, he shouldn't forget that the body is just a means to the soul. So he should be. So therefore, that's the idea, a reminder. And the same thing with the bias. And the house. The house is the protection. Physical protection, security, and so forth. So a person, when he gets involved in that area, he should realize that he's protecting himself physically, not because that's his essence to have a physical life, but also that while he's involved in that, he should be concerned about the care of the soul. So that's the mezuzah. Yichud Hashem, all the important ideas. That becomes part of your bias. So you shouldn't lose track of that idea. So the question is, if that's the case, so why must I have a physical reminder? Why don't you just tell a person, just teach a person that idea. That when he's involved in taking care of his body, he should take care of his soul as well. The answer is because it's not enough the way a person functions. You know, he's a creature of emotions and senses and so on and so forth, and he needs a concrete reminder to tell him to totally realize, to totally relate to a person on the level that he's at. Somebody who's a totally involved philosophy doesn't need these things. You just teach him the ideas and he'll look correctly. But that's a very high level. Most people aren't on that level, at least at first. So you have to work out a whole system in which you incorporate true abstract ideas into concrete things that a person is always going to encounter. He encounters the mezuzah. He reminds him of the Shema Yisrael. He reminds him of the ideas. So it gives him a whole different orientation. And the same is true. Even in his begotten, he needs tzitzis because it's a reminder. So the Torah utilizes things in the concrete physical world in order to help a person integrate certain ideas. Now, I think that's the manner in which the Nachash is operating over here. Now, what is the Nachash, as far as the Torah is concerned, the Nachash has a certain symbolical significance. Symbolic of an idea, representative of an idea. And we encounter the Nachash in Bereshit, as you well know. That is in the story of the Chet. And it says, "Va'nachash ha'yorom," the Torah depicts the Chet of Adam and Chava. And it begins with a conversation, right? That the Nachash was responsible. The Nachash talks to Chava. Is it true that you can't eat from all the fruits of the trees and so on and so forth? And persuades her to go ahead and eat. Now the question arises: what's going on? Is this a real snake? Is it? How do we understand the story? Do we take it literally? Is it a real snake? And was there another being with intelligence that was had speech and the power of speech? And so on and so forth. There's different interpretations. The Sforno learns that is not to be taken literally. That the in other words, the story of the Chet, of course, is true. It's not an allegory. The story of the Chet cannot be taken as an allegory. It happened. She did violate the command and eat of that of the forbidden fruit and the changes that occurred and so forth. That's all true. But this element, the dialogue with the snake, according to the Sforno, it's not a physical snake. But rather, the snake is symbolic. It's an allegorical of what? Of the Yetzer Hara. You take a look at the Sforno in Bereshit, Hanachash, the Hanachash, he says, Hu Satan. That is Satan. And what is Satan? Hu Yetzer Hara. That is the evil inclination. Rav HaHezek in Miut HaYosonira. It is, there's a great deal of damage due to the fact that it's not visible. It's invisible. In other words, the way I understand this Sforno, what happened was like this. She sinned because of her evil inclination. Got the better of her. But the Torah is depicting an inner struggle as though it were between two separate forces, to make it clear to you. So in other words, the dialogue between the woman and the snake is really, isn't it, like, you know, you're talking to yourself, like two sides, like you have a conflict. And one side of you is saying you should do such and such. You know, that's the
V'yetara. But then the other side is saying, no, I really shouldn't do such and such, because, and then one side wins out over the other. So that could be depicted as though it were a discussion between two separate forces. Now the question arises, first of all, what exactly is V'yetara? What is V'yetara? And secondly, why is V'yetara depicted through a snake? Why is it depicted through a snake? But the first question is, what is the Yetzirah? We know that the Torah speaks about the Yetzirah, and the Torah speaks about the Yetzirah Tov. The good inclination, the bad inclination. Now, what is the good inclination, and what's the bad inclination? And I'll go even further, how could there be such a thing as a bad inclination? Right? We discussed last week, Yetzirah, Adam, Ram, and Urav, and so forth, that the inclination of man's heart is evil. How can there be such a thing? Evil inclination. What is it? Locate it for me. What is the evil inclination? It's concretely, specifically, what exactly is the evil inclination? Okay, I'll just stop then. I'll ask this question. Go ahead. What is it?
Now you say that the evil inclination is the instinct. What are the instincts?
The instincts of eating. Is there anything evil about that? The sexual instinct. Is there anything evil about that? The aggressive instinct. Is there anything evil about that? Well, how can it be evil if it's part of nature? It's part of God implanted it within me. That's the way I'm supposed to be. What's evil about that? What is evil? Do we believe that eating is evil? Because it's an instinct? That's my question. I'm going to give you a chance. Very complicated. This whole idea that there is within man a Yetzirah Tov, a good inclination, and there is within man a Yetzirah Hara, a bad inclination, is a very... So what's going on over here? I mean, we have two forces and they both battle it out. So first of all, where is free will? If that's the case. That's just a question. Well, it also interesting, okay, it also interesting enough, the Chazal said that you should serve God, it becomes a little bit funny, because the Yetzer itself could become the Yetzer Hara. And the Yetzer Hara could become, they could sort of live, because it says that you should serve God with your Yetzer Hatov and with the Yetzer Hara. Now, how can anybody make sense out of a statement like that? Now, where is the State Farm Pasuk in the Torah? Which Pasuk? Bechal Levavcha B'shnei Yetzirecha. Serve God with both of your Yetzers. Oh, that's really nice. So then how is it evil? So that's a good. So we have, this is a little bit confusing now. I've got the evil inclination, which is going against God. The good one is going towards God. So first of all, to tell me to serve God with my good inclination doesn't make sense either. Because that one is, that's what makes it good by nature. So what are you telling me to serve God with my good inclination? That is what my good inclination is, by definition. I mean, I could not serve God with my good inclination? You know, it's possible that I could use my good inclination and it wouldn't be said, then it's not good. And then they're telling me the bad inclination is bad because it's against serving God, but I'm going to serve God with my bad inclination. How do these things work? The whole thing is very complicated. With my Yetzirah Tov, I could be disobedient to God. So what kind of Yetzirah Tov is that? And with my Yetzirah Ra, I could be obedient to God. So what's wrong about that? That's a little bit tough. That challenges all of the things that we learn as kids. There's such a simple little world out there, you know? It's so simple. In other words, there are three forces in man that we're talking about. Yetzer is inclination, instinct. Now, according to Yahadus, there's no such thing as a person who's good by nature or bad by nature. There's no such thing. And what society, what society regards as a praise. Like, sometimes you find a person who's extremely nice, just by nature, very nice guy. And, you know, people praise him. It's not, this person is so nice, it's just in his nature, he couldn't hurt a fly. But people think that's the more wonderful, so good that it could. That's not really a praise, because if it means that's just the person's emotions, he's just following his emotions. And you know, this virtue, there's no such thing, there's no virtue which is purely in line with an emotion. It's an impossibility. And, in order, virtue demands that a person is always acting in accordance with the correct idea, with truth, with emes. You see, by David, by Yisrael b'chol b'rachav maskil, it says that David b'chol b'rachav, the perfected individual, as far as Yahadus, is the person b'chol b'rachav maskil, that he uses his intelligence and seichel in every area, v'ashem imo, and in God's will. But a person that's operating with emotions, and following certain emotions, that's not the best, that's away from the path of perfection. Now, well, there is a, but we do have emotions, and emotions do play a role. You see the Yaakov Ishtam,
people make a mistake. They think that Esav was predestined to be a Russian, and Yaakov was predestined to be a Tzaddik. You know the whole thing when she walked by, when she was pregnant, she walked by the Beis Medrash, so Yaakov jumped, and then she walked by the house by Dalek. People should be aware of making a serious mistake if there's any kind of predestination. If Esav was predetermined to be a Russian, I would say anything like that. Free will. The Rambam talks about this in the Shemot HaPrachim. It means that each person is born with different sets of emotions, constitutionally and so forth, and each one has a different type of a struggle to overcome. Esav had total free will, but each person has their own personal Melchemes HaChayim. Each person has their own type of a battle, because that's the Chachmas Hashem, that you know we're all human, and generally speaking we have the same general emotions, but the particularities are such that no one individual is similar to another. Chazal say that. It's like the difference between, that's why they say when a person kills, what a terrible thing it is to take away someone. Each Bria has a certain uniqueness, that when a person mints something, mints a coin, produces many coins, but they're all identical. They're all exactly the same. But the Akharish Bark was able to mint a coin. We're all human, we all share the same definition, but each one is particular, each one is different. The way the emotions are set up in each person in such a way that no individual is like another individual. No such thing as being identical, it's an impossibility. And you'll see, no matter how, you may find a face person is looking for someone that's just like themselves, a friend, whatever the case, and you found someone who's just like you, if you get to know the person more, you'll see it's not just, it's different. There's differences. It means each person has their own Melchemes HaChayim. So we all have free will, and we all relate to the good, and then you have to apply it. Your test in life is to perfect yourself, utilizing your own Chachma and your own Bechira. And each person, of course, each person looks at the other one and says, how easy it is. You know, that person doesn't have the same struggle that I have overcoming this emotion. I have this type of. This person doesn't care about these things. I have the other type. Each person feels, you know, tend to feel that life is more difficult for them. It's much harder for them. But that's absurd, because you have no way of evaluating somebody else's struggle. It's an impossibility. But each person has a struggle. There is no such thing as a naturally perfected person that didn't have to go through a struggle. And utilization of their free will. And overcoming of the Yetzer Hara. There's no such thing. Yaakov had to overcome his emotions of the niceness. He was Yishtam, Yoshev Ohom. And that too could be a problem. Because when you're dealing in the world of reality, you encounter a loved one. You can't be nice. Because then you're going to allow evil to triumph in the world. And you're going to fight against evil. So you can't be, just to be a nice guy, see, people think that's an outside today. Outside today is a perfect example of where the Yetzer HaTov is really Yetzer Hara. Let's take the case of compassion. You have a terrible, we've been discussing it last week, a terrible breakdown in terms of law and order. If you pick up the papers every day, the amount of crime, killing, raping, and the disgusting things, even if it's gotten to the point of a breakdown of society, even in a place like going to a municipal pool, you read about these things that are going on, the attack, and there's like total animalistic behavior. And this is a structured situation. I don't know if people realize, the authorities realize how serious this is. Even if a person is not being killed, but it reveals the extent that even in a situation where people are expected, it's not a 3 in the morning in Central Park where there's nobody, you'd expect criminals to hang out over there. But here it's where there are lifeguards. People wouldn't have thought of doing a thing like this the other day. But there's a tremendous, in our society, there's a tremendous emotion of compassion for the criminal. And that's why they liberalization to make it to understand to try and cure therapy rather therapy is the thing. And we can't punish someone because we don't understand this tremendous emotion of sympathy and compassion. And the death penalty is out because that's cruel. That's cruelty. Now, of course, the person in his own mind thinks that he's a target because he feels better, even if he would recognize it's an interesting thing. That, see, if a person punishes, parents feel the same way too, by the way. You'll see, some people in the audience will know that, that when a parent faces the choice, when their child does something wrong, so so either you, you can punish, or sometimes, you know, you feel guilty, you don't want to punish. Now, in the case, let's say you made a wrong decision. So if you punished and it was too harsh, so then you feel really sick. But let's say you failed to punish, and then you realize it was wrong, I should have. Then the parent, the person doesn't. That's always the easier, it's always easier for the parent. But psychologically, it's more in line with their natural emotion to be nice. But as far as Yadus is concerned, that's equally evil. In other words, to be compassionate in a situation where that compassion is misplaced is evil. That's what you do with a strong society. That's why Shaul lost the kingship, was uprooted because of the chait of what? The chait was compassion. Compassion against the Lord. He failed to kill Agag. That was a serious, serious chait with terrible, terrible consequences. Because we know that who came from Agag? We're very sure that's Haman. Haman came from Agag. This was Amalek. You're dealing with Amalek. You're not allowed to show any type of compassion. So a person that cannot control his emotion of compassion in that situation is an imperfected individual. And that's a terrible, terrible chait. So you see that as far as Yadus is concerned, there is no such thing as an emotion which is inherently good. And then, of course, there's no such thing as an emotion which is inherently bad. Because emotions can't be either good or bad, they're just emotions. And that part of, and it's obviously, in a sense, I mean, it's good that a person should have emotions. If a person was born without emotions, that would be a problem, that would be an abnormality. It's like a person being born without hands, that would be an abnormality. Because in order for a person to perfect himself, it's necessary for him to have emotions. It's part of this part of his definition as a human being.
If he didn't have emotions,
there wouldn't be, yeah, so he wouldn't be man, he wouldn't be other. So it would be bad. As God, in other words, it's God's will that there should be a creature defined as Adam who utilizes his Bechira in order to effectuate his perfection. And that requires that he have emotion.
Sometimes it's like the person that they make
all decisions
about their
emotion. When they are in line with their true purpose. They're bad when they're not in line. Now, in terms of making a decision, in coming to a conclusion, the force within you that should be responsible is reason, rationality. The decision should be based upon knowledge, upon reason, upon the seichel. Now, the seichel will utilize the emotions too, because the emotion could be a barometer. In other words, in a simple case, like you need to say, when I get married, I shouldn't use my emotion. I should just be rational. In other words, just look for certain qualities. That the person is good, that the person is intelligent, this and that, and that's it. And I shouldn't I shouldn't think about my emotions. What about my emotions? Right? I'm giving you a simple case. Well, people say, well, you're saying that we shouldn't have emotions. We shouldn't follow our emotions. My emotions are not in line with this particular individual, but rationally I realize this person is very good. So I would say that that's irrational. Because since that's part of marriage, is to have a relationship, which is a part of that, a very significant part, obviously, is the emotional, because the emotion wants to be there. But I would tell you, though, is don't let the emotion make the decision. Your mind should make the decision based upon all the factors, one of which is emotion, is the emotion is there. But other questions, well, I may feel about the person in a certain way, but what qualities does the person have? You know, can the person earn a living? Does the person have good meadows? Does the person this, that? So then, the mind takes all these things into consideration. But the emotional is a very significant one. And the same is true with anything. There's nothing wrong when you buy something. A house, whatever it is, a part of it is emotional. But the emotion can't make the decision. You can't, what I'm saying is you don't say, I'm going to do it because I feel I have to have something. That would be absurd. You don't, well, when you do, on your health, you don't do something because I feel I should be doing that. You go to a doctor and ask what the doctor says. Knowledge is you know, that's one thing. That the emotions are valid, and the emotions must be satisfied, and they should be satisfied in an intelligent way. But the emotions are not qualified to tell you what's happening in reality. In other words, if you feel very strongly that we should go to war against Assyria. You feel very strongly about it. You have a very powerful emotion. Or you feel very strongly that we should give back all the West Bank. Then we would say that's a feeling, but no intelligent person would say that. But the fact that you feel that way doesn't indicate that that's the truth, that it's real. You would ignore that. So you feel that way. You have learned enough by now to know that just because you have a certain feeling doesn't mean that that's the way the reality is.
Oh.
Well, most people in the world have not learned that.
I want you to know that.
That's exactly what most people have not learned. And the mistake that all people make is that they are totally convinced that their feelings are very much in line with reality. And the intelligent person says, okay, so I have a feeling. Now let me test it out with my mind. It could very well be that feeling is in line with reality. It could very well be that feeling is not in line with reality. And I've done, you know, over the years being a rabbi, part of doing this marriage counseling, I've seen many people who have had very powerful feelings that this is it. And afterwards they can't believe, at that time they couldn't believe that their feeling could be wrong, when they had the feeling. And afterwards they couldn't believe that they ever had such a feeling in the first place. So, or that they could have believed in their feeling so much. So, feelings are important, but the point is, you don't believe in your feelings, that your feelings are the barometer. The only thing you have within you that is, that God did implant within you, the Talon Elohim. And that is the part of you that does have access to reality. And we are the only beings that have that. No other creature in the creation has that. And God did give us a means by which we can have access to reality through the utilization of our Talon Elohim. And that's what you always have to be aware of. If it's just making a decision about reality, it's the Talon Elohim. The Talon Elohim can use the evidence of the senses, can use feelings, because sometimes a person that knows and the area has a certain feel for things, can use it, but the final decision must be the Talon Elohim, and even then you can be mistaken. Well, that doesn't mean to say you'll always be right. Because since you're Adam, you're going to make mistakes. But that's the only way to go. Okay? To sum it up then, I think what we're saying is like this, that man has different instincts within him. And no instinct by itself is either good or bad. It all depends upon how the individual utilizes it. So why did the Torah introduce this concept of the Yetzer HaTov or Yetzer HaRa? It's what Carolyn said before, that there are two different sets of instincts within man. One is the basic instinctual, those that stem from the instinctual side, the emotions that stem from the instinctual side of man, so that, which would be the appetitive, eating, the instincts for eating, the sexual, the aggressive instincts. Those instincts are generally regarded as the Yetzer HaRa. Nothing wrong about them, but they tend to push the person in a certain direction. It's an inclination. That's why it's an inclination. It means it inclines the person. He's got to, by and large, those are the ones that he has to combat. The egotistical. Because by and large, if he doesn't rein them in, they have to be reined in. See? Then because eating, lust pulls a person in a certain direction. And if he doesn't check it in, it's going to cause his destruction. Because it's going to give him nothing wrong with pleasure. But what's wrong with pleasure is that it distorts the person's sense of what's good and what's bad. Because there's a very powerful force in man that associates the good with the pleasant. Right? That it feels so good, it has to be right. That's a very powerful force you have to watch out for within yourself. How can something which feels so good be wrong? Well, the answer is, the fact that it feels so good has nothing to do with whether it's right or wrong. Meaning that people begin to idolize things. I pointed out in sports. People why do they worship these sports heroes? Because since they enjoy it so much, it's so pleasant to them, they have to project value onto it. Honestly, it becomes something which is important. It becomes something which is good. You always find that process happening. When you find something which you like, you don't just say, I like it, but it becomes great. It becomes wonderful. So that's a very value. It's a distortion of values. That's why it's the Yetzer HaRa. Because it has a tendency to give you a false picture of reality. In today's society, total false picture of the ultimate good is this elusive romantic experience that everybody says, that's the ultimate good. Where does it come from? It's based upon emotions. And that's why that set of emotions is referred to as the Yetzer HaRa. Now what's the Yetzer HaTov? The Yetzer HaTov is that God implanted another force within man. And that is basically this ego ideal that each person has. The superego, the ego ideal, which is responsible for what we know of as conscience, which acts in a manner which restrains. See, the other set of emotions, the emotion of compassion. The emotion of compassion goes counter to the emotion of aggression. A person has a certain emotion of aggression. But then he also has the emotion of compassion. That's based upon identification. He feels bad when he's hurting somebody else. So the emotion of compassion would be referred to as a good emotion. It's just an emotion in and of itself. The person just did a good deed purely because he was overcome by an emotion of compassion. So where there was no bechira there, where's the goodness? What's the difference between him and the person that did a different deed? One that comes along and takes his banana and peels it on the floor. He's above. The other one comes along and he's overcome by a pure emotion. It's not a different thing. It's an instinctive reaction. Picks it up and because last week he tripped over a banana peel, whatever. Or like a bottle in the street. Last week he got a flat tire. And he says, this is disgusting. And he throws it, right? No thought. It's just an emotion. And he throws it and he's a tzaddik. It's one emotion. It should be. They're both operating on pretty much the same level. But this one, his emotions are more in line with the true good. Because the true good is that we should act in a way, which is, but we shouldn't just be involved in the primitive ego, in the infantile ego. We should act in a way which is in line. So that emotion, when he's engaged in that, he will distance himself from those emotions which keep him in an infantile state. And when he does practice these deeds, it will bring him to a higher intellectual level. So that's why that's called the Yetzer HaTov, because by and large, these emotions are pushing him in a different direction. That's why God structured the emotion in such a way so that the mind now, that's the you. That part of you which we'll call, for practical purposes, that the ego, the part of you that's conscious, right? The conscious part of you, the rational part of you, the thinking part of you. It's not always rational, because even the thinking part sometimes thinks with the emotion. That conscious part of you, the part of you that makes the decision, the decision maker, the one that has that sense of self-consciousness, that you can sense both. You sense your taiva. You sense your superego. You have to now serve God with both. You see? You have now bechira. Because God implanted certain emotions. Then God implanted those to help you counter it. But now you got to make a decision. You can serve God with your yetzara. You can take your instinctive energies, your aggressive energies, and direct it towards a project which is serving Torah. You see? And in a simplistic way, I'll give you a simplistic case, but you're also a Chazal thing. You see, Chazal did not have this Christian approach of recession, that there's something evil about the instinct. Chazal say that if a person senses that he has a very powerful, aggressive emotion, a lot of aggressiveness, so he should choose a certain profession. What profession? Yeshafik. So why is it true? Why? Because he's gonna be able to have an outlet. He's able to express a lot of his aggressiveness. But he's doing it in an intelligent way, because now the first thing he has to go to Beis Medrash. He has to learn. He has to start studying, go through all the areas of Allah. And then he has to train, and so on and so forth. And he's involved in doing something which is a mitzvah, which perfects him. So now he's utilizing his aggressive energy to perform mitzvah. And that itself will be the emotional impetus for raising him to a higher level. So that's serving God with your yetzara. And there's many, many more sophisticated examples. And the same is true with the yetzara tov. You have to serve God with the yetzara tov. If a person's in a situation and he's overcome with too much compassion and he can't punish his child or punish his student or get tough with people, so then he's not serving God with the yetzer. Then his yetzer hara is completely in control of him. He's totally controlled, and that's evil. A person that's totally controlled by his emotions that's evil. That's destruction. That's the analysis of this parasha. The idea that there's a yetzer hara, there's a yetzer hara, and the perfected individual realizes that there's no such thing as following any emotion. Any emotion, if you just think you can rely on any emotion, it'll always guide you, you're wrong. There's always going to be cases where the emotion itself will be in conflict with the good, and if you follow the emotion, you will not be in line with the good, and you'll be in opposition to the will of God. You always must use your Tzelem Elokim. Okay? It is good, however, to cultivate, this is very important though, one should strive to cultivate certain emotions. Ramban says, for example, that the most important emotion that one should cultivate is what? Compassion. Rahim. To be a merachim. To be a merachim. Because by and large, of all the emotions, that's the one that in most situations will be beneficial if you're a merachim. It will lead you. But even that is not foolproof, as we see. But that is very, very important. And Chazal said that there's a three qualifications of a Jew, three identifying marks. Rachmanim, Kaishanim, Adol Mechasod. That the Jews are Rachmanim, they are merciful, Kaishan, modesty, they have modesty, not exhibitionists, and so forth. This type of behavior that you're reading about, you know, with the pools and everything, this couldn't be with Jews, couldn't be. If there were people there with Jewish names doing this kind of thing, then I would question their lineage, I really would. Because it's not by Shanim. And Gomer Chasodim. Gomer Chasodim means they do deeds of chesed, of helping other people. Those are the three characteristics. So there are certain emotions that it's good to cultivate. You should cultivate them. But when you cultivate them, realize that you're cultivating them because it's a step on the way. It's going to ease the path in terms of perfection. But in and of itself, it's not an end in itself. It's not to be regarded as an end in itself. But it's to say that if I've cultivated the emotion of Rachmanis, now I'm perfected. Now, it all depends on how you utilize it in terms of situations that arise in life. Okay, so let's talk about hatred for a second. The Rambam in Perek El Hazavel, Perek Aleph, towards the end he goes into various cases. Do you mourn for everybody? We're talking now about relatives. Excuse me, the seven relatives that you normally would be obliged to mourn for. There was. Now there's two categories of people who are executed in Jewish law, to be executed. Well, we have the proper system of government in effect, which would be Sanhedrin. We'd have the Sanhedrin and we'll have a kingship. You know, the Torah's form of government is to have a properly appointed melech, king. Now the king has the power to execute individuals who rebel against him without going through the normal channels of the Sanhedrin, even if the person has not committed a capital crime. Because according to the Torah, certain averos are carried a death penalty, as you know, very serious averos. Killing and Chil Shabbos and adultery, very, very serious crimes. But other crimes don't carry the death penalty. But a melech has a tremendous power. That if any individual rebels against him, as Mori B'malchus, he has the right to kill him if he so chooses. He doesn't have to kill him. Okay? Now the Rambam says, Arugei Malchus, those who are killed by the king, Sarei Elam is Ablin Aleihem. Their relatives have to mourn for them. They're entitled to a full Avelos. Okay? Then he says, Avo Kol Arugei Bezdin, Ein Mas Ablin Aleihem. But Arugei Bezdin, those who are killed by Bezdin. For example, it didn't happen, as you know, the death penalty was infrequently given. But there was a person who was found guilty by the Sanhedrin of Shul Shabbos, and he was executed. So the relatives would not shiva. There's no shiva. There's no avails. And what's the difference? What's the reason for this? The reason is because when the person is executed by the Bezdin, so his status is changed to that of a Rasha. He has a status of being a Rasha. He's found guilty, and therefore he has a status of being a Rasha. So there's no Avelus for a Rasha. Why? Because Avelus is Kavod. The whole underlying obligation of mourning is for Kavod. Kavod Hames. And by the way, that explains why for every other relative it's only 30 days. For parents it's Yud Beis Chodesh. It's 12 months. That's the only case. And why are parents... Why do you have to mourn longer for parents? The answer is because in mourning for parents, which is covered in mace, he has kibirav. Kibirav ein. Even if they're dead, it's still a fulfillment of the mitzvah of kibirav ein. That's why it's longer than any other relative. Even if the other relative is close to you emotionally, it doesn't matter. Now, Harugei Malchus, however, the gavra is not a Russian. The gavra is not a Russian because the act that he did, it may not have been that terrible. But nevertheless, by the system of government, the Torah gave the king the power to execute him in order to maintain the society. There shouldn't be rebellion in society. But he himself has not been qualified as a Rasha. So you do mourn for him. Okay. That's just by way of introduction. Now he goes like this. Kalaporshin midachei tibur. All those who separate themselves from the way of the tibur, from the Jewish community. Ve'em ha'anashim shaparku ol ha'mitzvos me'al tavara. And they are people who've cast off the yoke of mitzvahs from their shoulders. That means, like, not just people that aren't totally firm, but people who've just cast it off completely. They don't regard themselves. In other words, I don't think it means, therefore, a person that partially, you know, you have today a lot of different gradations. There are people that are totally religious, there are people that are partially, but not completely observant, and then there are less observant. He's talking about someone that totally has nothing to do with Judaism at all. He's cast off the yoke of mitzvahs completely. The Einich Lolin Bechlal Yisrael Basiyas HaMitzvos U'Bechvod HaMalados V'Yeshivas Bate Knesios U'Bate Medrashos. Here he's talking about people that have totally broken their association with Klal Yisrael. They don't regard themselves as Jews. There are people like that. They want no part of the Jewish people. They don't want to be known. They may not convert because they don't really care. That's not the point. They don't want to be. They're totally assimilated, and they're not Jewish. They don't. They never go to a synagogue. They never observe any Jewish holiday. They don't get involved if there's a calamity with regard to the Jews or Israel. They don't want to be Jewish. They regard themselves as being totally free, independent. They're not part of this people. That's one category. The same are Bikrusin, Vamumrim, Vamusrim, Kol Elu. Then there's other categories. These are classical cases of Bikrusin. People that don't believe in God, don't believe in Torah. Okay? Aside from the first category, are people who just don't want to be part of the Jewish nation. Which would mean even if they believe in God. Kol Elu Amos Avon Aleim. Okay? All these people you don't want to know. It's their irrelevant later. But that's one second. That doesn't end. So far, it's not so terrible. It's not so controversial. But one second. Instead, we have a substitute. Instead of that, instead of mourning for them, what do? We make a party. Yeah? See, in the first case, the person has been executed by Bezin, you don't have a veil. There's no chiyuv veil. But that's it. That's because you can't be mezavel. The Torah doesn't like you because by being mezavel you're given kavod, and kavod you can't give to a Russian. Here you have another chiyuv. You have a chiyuv to celebrate. Ela acheihem, but their brothers or sisters, doesn't matter, ushar kroveihem, the relatives, those who would normally be in mourning, lo shin levanim, they dress up in white, which means to say you're nice clothing, umesachim levanim, the ochlim v'shosim, they eat and drink, usmeichem, and they make it and they rejoice. You make a party. Sharei avdu son of Shalakai Barakul. Because a great, wonderful thing has happened. The enemies of God have been killed, are dead. Va'aleyem akasav omer, and concerning them does the Pasuk say, halo misanecha ad Hashem esna. Those who hate you, who hate you, O Lord, do I hate? So, is it a mitzvah to hate? Certainly is. A person that would not. It's very interesting how most people's emotions, I guess if a person is in this situation, he'd have a big emotional conflict. What to do? He'd have a big emotional conflict. What to do? And this would be a tremendous test of a person's emotional perfection. The Torah is very concerned about emotions. We've gone totally to the opposite of the Torah. This is what we're talking here about emotions. And if you don't have the right emotions, then you're imperfected. But you can have a bit of an emotional conflict, I'd imagine, because if this person was your relative, was your brother, or whatever it was, or it could be your own child, so you can have one set of emotion. You're not going to feel this way. On the other hand, if you say the Rambam, right, you're supposed to have a totally different emotion, and now you're supposed to be having fun. So what do you see from this? That there is such a thing as emotional perfection. But emotional perfection is, and then the Torah is very concerned about emotion. Because a person, it's not just indifference here. It's not enough. I mean, if I told you didn't have to mourn, that you'd accept. Okay, you know, that wouldn't be so difficult. Oh, so you don't want to mourn. So what do I do about my emotional mourning? So I say suppress it. They say, okay, I'll suppress it. That wouldn't bother you so much. But now I'm telling you, you've got to rejoice. But that's a little bit more difficult.
Should you hate the person who is so much that they hate God? I mean, you know, they're obviously the ones that
they're lost. That's not the question. The question is, should you hate that person?
I
That's the question. Well, what does the Rambam say?
I know, that's
the time. Okay, so you'll help me out. So you answer, let's continue the discussion. Point out, you just mentioned, you mentioned this about applying the Torah to society. This type of a thing is very much a feature, I believe, of our society, our culture. Like this would be, this would go against the grain. Now, why should we have to hate? Shouldn't we rather pity the person? And the answer is no. No, that's inappropriate. The emotion of pity in this case would be inappropriate. And well, I'm going to try to understand why. The emotion of hatred would be appropriate. But the very fact that it bothers everybody, and I put myself, we all have the same thing. The very, why would it even bother us? That shows something about the way we've been trained to look at things. That there's something wrong about hating. The very fact that we even raise that question, shouldn't we rather just pity that person? That's a typical response. Many modern audiences would have that same typical thing. I don't know if you ever hear of Dee Clarkfeld, anybody? No? She's a famous Nazi hunter. She's from Germany. She's not Jewish. She married a Jewish guy. But she, other than that, she's a very righteous person. She was raised in Germany after the war, and she discovered what had taken place and how they covered it up. They don't teach in Germany. She devoted her life towards tracking down Nazis and doing everything she could to support Israel, you know, towards influencing Germany and Europe. She's a great woman. She's been there many times. She's been both very courageous. Very courageous individual. Because she was protesting the fact that there was, I forget who the chancellor was of Germany. Was it France? I'm not sure. I don't think so. There was a chancellor of Germany, and she was protesting that there was a former Nazi still in the government, and he wasn't doing anything about it. Oh, he was still one, I think there was one. I'm struggling with the fact that. I think there was one who had he was questionable. He himself had been a member of the Nazi party or something, and she said it was a disgrace that he was the chancellor, and she was protesting, and nobody was doing anything, and there was a gathering, some kind of convention or whatever, and he was going to speak, and she managed to get in there somehow, in the guise of being a reporter, something like that, and when he got to the podium, made her way up to the front, and to dramatize the situation, she went right up to him, and she slapped him in the face, and she started yelling Nazi and everything, and, you know, she just takes a tremendous amount of courage. Of course, they carted her off, but, they threw her in jail, whatever. But, I was at years ago, I think it was Beth Shalom, they had a dad speak. And I went because I had read her books, you know, and I had a great deal of admiration for what she was doing, and I wanted to meet her, and I wanted to hear her. And there were people were asking questions, and she was saying how important it is not to let these Nazis who are living in peace in various countries, in Argentina, whatever, to get away with it. And it's a terrible disgrace that the world sits back, and it's basically allowing them to get, to live peaceful lives. It's like you're forgiving them and all that. And wouldn't you know, this is the Gentile talking. To a Jewish audience, so this Jewish liberal has to get up. You know, isn't it maintaining this hatred after all these years? You know, isn't it rather hollow to do? You know, that type of thing. I'm not, not running back to you. I'm not saying that's what you're saying. But I'm just saying that's the type of attitude that our society creates. It's a purely emotional kind. It's unpleasant. It's unpleasant for me to look at myself as someone who hates. I can't look at myself as that. So why do we have to? You know, what's the benefit of this kind of thing? Now, the Torah says differently. The Torah says that in this situation, it's no pity, hatred. At what? Let's explain it. The Rambam is saying, really, pitying is okay. It is appropriate, but we're afraid we can't trust the person. Once he's going to start to pity, then he's going to not take justice, right? What's the point? Okay, that's a practical answer, but I don't buy it. I'm saying more. No pity, hatred. Hatred is perfection. Let me ask you to really bring this thing into focus. Let me ask you a question. Would you pity Hitler? If he was doing Catherine? If he was really alive, according to those myths?
I would say my explanation
to
hate him
is
to strangle him
and
deny that.
So why don't you say the same
thing? No, he has the information. But if you hear something, you say this is a man, he's so
There is no such thing. If you read, I don't know what you've read of Holocaust literature. I've read a great deal of it. I have family that went through the concentration camps. My father was one of the few individuals that survived Auschwitz. As a fellow of Russia, he's not alive, but he did survive. One of the few, because the average lifespan was 2 or 3 months. And he was extremely strong. His whole family was killed except for one son and a nephew. He gave him a lot. I mean, I've heard all tremendous, stories of what went on and everything, and I've read about these butchers. And you can't tell me that you, and the biggest of all was Hitler, and you don't have any. And when you read about these guys that are finally caught, this guy in France or the other ones, and then you read that, a guy like Eichmann, and he was one of the few, he was the only one that Israel ever tried and executed, the only person that Israel ever executed. The reaction is that he got off easy. That's pretty easy for everything that he did. It's bothersome. It bothers him that all you could do is basically kill him. But what we would like to do is to set up something to really torture the guy. And I'm serious. Oh, we're ashamed to talk this way. But I don't believe that anybody is going to witness this type of thing. I mean, a person would, and this is not you, but a person that would, like this individual, it seems to me that a person that even has such an inclination to take pity on a Nazi would be the person who separated himself from the Jewish people. That's an attitude. These people, like this guy, William Kunstler, you heard about him. You know, he's the guy that defends all the his lawyer, Jewish lawyer. whose Jewishness I would have to question. And he defended this guy Nosir, killed Kahani. And of course, these lawyers, always justify. They're only because of constitutional. It's not true. He's drawn out. He defends all these terrorists that were involved in the world. So the enemies of Israel. I mean, his passion is to defend the enemies of Israel. It's a passion. That's hatred of Jews. That's a Jewish self-hater, anti-Semite. It's a terrible thing. You can't. What is the emotion? What is the emotion you want? Does anybody want? If you have a capacity. This has nothing to do with upholding the system. If you have skills, you could distort things in a courtroom with 12 ordinary people that don't know better, and you could use your skills to distort the situation to let these murderers of Jews go through, and you use that skill, that can only make for one thing, and it's not for money. It's for hatred of Jews. But any person that would not have a feeling of hatred for Hitler, I don't understand you. I would say there's something wrong with that person. I don't believe there's no way you can have pity. You would have there's a discussion. It's like somebody took your child and tortures your child, pulls out its nails, subjected to a helpless little child, and you witness it. And you don't hate that person? Well, if you didn't, then I'd say there's something wrong. I'd say there's something wrong with you. Psychologically, I said, yeah, we've got a problem there. Which could very well be in our society, because I always see after, we all these terrible atrocities where these killers have done things to these innocent teenagers, and very often the parents, we don't hate, we just try to understand. It's like a Christian sickness, they're always there understanding. I said, what are you sick? What do you don't hate? How could you not hate? This is evil. You have to hate evil. Now, my point is, that this is precisely the point. The perfected individual will have the same hatred for true evil. What's the ultimate evil? The Sanhedrin. If a person loves, you cannot have it both ways. Is there a mitzvah to love God? Is there a mitzvah to love God? Well, then you cannot have a mitzvah to love God and not have a mitzvah to hate those who destroy that whole kindness, to hate for shame. It's an impossibility. You can't say, I love God, but I pity the other. The fact of the matter is that you are a creature of emotion. We are emotional. And there is a reality to how the emotions operate. It's, for example, like we explained the idea of Avos Hashem, which could be a separate topic, and I didn't take it up, but the concept is, you can't really, how can you really love God? There's a problem. How can you really love God when the Yadav teaches us that we can't know God? That God is unknowable by nature. So it's a contradiction with terms. God, on the one hand, if you form any concept of God, that's the Avos Hashem. You can't form any concept of God. God is unknowable by nature. So what we know is that God is the source. We don't know anything that's positive about God. On the other hand, we command to love God. Now, how can you love God if the emotion of love only operates with regard to something you have to have a concept of what it is? You can love, you don't have to love a city, you can love a country, but do you have a concept of what it is? Or an ideal? So the way the Rambam understands it, it's as a person begins to appreciate, has a sense of appreciation and love and awe for God's Chokhmah, as it's revealed in Torah and in the creation, he wants to get closer to God. He has a desire to get to know. That desire to get closer and closer is what we call love. Number one, why do you call that love? So the explanation is because that's an offshoot of love. In other words, anyone that knows anything about human emotion knows that when you fall in love, every true love is accompanied by a desire to be with. And you know very well, I mean, is there anyone who's had this emotion knows that when you love somebody, you want to be with that object of love. And if someone were to tell you, and you know when things are cooling off, and someone were to sort of like not be that anxious to be with you, well, I really love it.